Hello, everyone, and welcome to Space Junk, a weekly podcast dedicated to the amazing hobby of amateur astronomy. Each week, we'll bring you interesting and fun discussions with an eye towards providing you with the latest information and advice on the tools, gadgets, software, and techniques for maximizing your enjoyment of the night sky. Your hosts are Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space and Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes, a world leader in telescopes and accessories. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Space Junk. We've got another podcast planned for you today. This is your chance to get caught up on all the really cool stuff from all the cool kids in the world of amateur astronomy. You are sitting, by listening to this podcast, at the cool kids table in the astrophotography cafeteria, because today we're going to be talking with Blake Estes. Dustin just got through telling me that he says Blake Estes is one of the top three planetary imagers in the world, right? Isn't that what you said, Dustin?
Yeah. This guy, so this is a close friend. Blake actually is part of the team here at OPT. And, you know, the first time I saw his planetary work, I it's very rare anymore that I see space images and think, oh yeah, that's fake. But this guy's stuff is so good. So good that it's hard to believe that some of it is real. But he's a phenomenal photographer, absolutely lives and breathes astrophotography, and uses some of the biggest systems in the world. So we can talk about all of that.
Yeah, great. So in addition to being one of the best imagers, planetary imagers in the world, he's also in training to become a telescope operator for two of the most iconic observatories in the United States, Mount Wilson Observatory, as well as Griffith Observatory, just outside of LA. So he is currently being trained to use these telescopes, and we're going to talk to him today about what these scopes are like and also about his imaging techniques and any advice that he might have for all of us. So, Blake, welcome to our humble podcast. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?
Now, you're with Dustin in the same room at OPT, right?
That's correct, yeah.
All right. So tell us a little bit I want to get into your imaging for sure, but I want also to learn about how you got involved with OPT as well as getting these positions at these observatories.
All righty. Well, I guess I should start with OPT first. I've always had an interest since Comet Hale-Bopp was in the sky. I think it was 96, 97. I think it was 97. But that's when I got my first, astronomical telescope. And it was one of those ones that you can get at like Walmart. They're like $50. And they say, oh, you know, 1,000 times magnification, you can see the moon and whatnot. And
yeah, I know just the one you mean.
I saw the comet through that telescope, and I was just mesmerized by it. You know, that this giant, object that just had this beautiful tail on it was in the sky for, several weeks, as I recall. And it became a curiosity and a desire to understand and capture these things and share it with the world, basically. It was the beginning of a long journey. And so fast forward, my buddy and I last year wanted to go really big on a project. So he and I are both graduates of Brooks Institute of Photography. And we kind of did our own thing regarding astronomical imaging there. And so he bought a $100,000, phase one setup, the IQ3-100. And basically what we wanted to do was we wanted to put this thing on a tracking mount and take these gorgeous, deep images of nebulas and whatnot. And so we were looking for the best company with the biggest selection. And of course, that was OPT. So we show up one day and, Dustin's up in the front counter there. And we take out this phase one and we said, hey, we want to take giant pictures of the night sky. And Dustin was like, you guys are cool.
I told you, cool kids table here, folks.
he said, well, why don't you work with us? And, we can do some really cool projects. And, I've been here ever since. I'm the technician. I have the opportunity to test amazing equipment with Dustin and for Dustin. I have a unique opportunity to test that in different locations, where the scene is really good, like Mount Wilson. Yeah, it's just been awesome. Everything's kind of come together like a puzzle almost.
Can you tell us what a phase one setup is?
Yeah, the phase one is a 6-4-5 format, medium format camera. And so this is this digital camera, very similar to the Mamiya 6-4-5 sensor. So it's 6 centimeters by 4.5 centimeters. That's the size of the piece of film that it would be. So it's very, very large compared to a 35 millimeter. And so this is a full digital sensor that's the same size. So it covers an enormous amount of space. And so the demands that it places on optics is, as you might imagine, quite high.
What's the pixel size?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't remember the pixel size, but I wanted to say they were around 5 microns.
Yeah, it had to be about that because, I mean, it was a huge chip, but, you know, still at that resolution, that many megapixels, it still keeps them relatively small.
Yeah. You know, we did do some experiments, and we found out that It works extremely well for galaxies, but not so much for nebulae. The filter that's normally on that digital back tends to cut off a lot of the red and hydrogen. Of course, it works wonderful for, you know, everything else, landscapes and studios and stuff. But now we're talking about the FLI 5100 chip, which is, it's basically the same size, but it's more suited for astronomy.
That's actually, so yeah, when Blake came in with his friend, that's kind of where it all started. I was, you know, it was very rare at that point that I was ever able to get up there to the showroom. You know, our old building was divided. It was two levels, and I was always kind of stuck down in the offices. But one of the sales guys came down and was like, "Hey, there's this camera up here. You're going to want to see. This thing's pretty incredible." So I came up there, and then, you know, Blake is a happy guy. He's up there holding this $100,000 camera. And we immediately started talking about these projects. And that's something that here we pretty much always have going on. There's always, what can we do bigger? What can we do better? What can be the first time something's done? And I was working on a project with the 5100 that Blake's talking about. This is a huge medium format camera. It's basically like two full frame chips combined. So set next to each other in red is one big chip. It is one big chip, but it reads out as two. That's how big it is. I mean, it's massive. And so when they started talking about this, this phase one, you know, it kind of registered that, hey, this is still a color sensor, right? It's going to have a Bayer matrix and it's going to have some limitations. We should put some equipment in your hands that's designed for this purpose. You know, let's cool it. Let's freeze the chip. Let's take some really long exposures. And the work that I had seen of Blake's to that point, Blake had shot on systems that were, I mean, relatively old. You know, they were still very, very good systems. I think you had an old Mead at the time, right? Mm-hmm. And a system that he loved. But, you know, there had been a lot of updates to equipment since then. And I just thought, if this is what this guy's producing now, with equipment that's, you know, 15 years old, what's going to happen if we put state-of-the-art stuff in this guy's hands and just say, run? So yeah, I mean, those are the kind of projects that we live for here at OPT. We're always looking for the new thing that we can do that's bigger or better or just different. And you take the newest, you know, the state-of-the-art equipment as it changes, as you get these new items that come out, it opens up new possibilities. You know, like for a long time, for instance, like narrowband filters were not a thing for a long time. And then once that became, you know, something that, you know, the common user could get, it changed things entirely, because then you could start shooting emission nebulae from your backyard, no matter where you were. And so, and that's just one example. And there are different examples every single day of the year with new equipment coming out. And so I was looking at Blake's stuff, and, you know, the stuff Blake was shooting was on a system that was, it had to be what, 10, 15 years old?
Yeah, it's actually, I kind of have a funny story about part of it. The system I had actually was what I got instead of a car when I turned 16. That's how much I was interested.
That's dedication right there, yeah. Right? Yeah, and so I was looking at it, and it's like, this guy's images are absolutely incredible, and he's doing it on this mount that most imagers would never want to deal with, the shake and the vibrations and all the tracking error and all of these problems. And I just thought, if we get some of this new equipment in this guy's hands, he's going to take this to an entirely new level. And so Blake and I started talking, and in the original discussions about working with OPT, we're in no way talks about like employment with the company. It was just we have a lending library here for our staff that has basically like one of everything. Anything the staff want to use, they pull it from what we call our lending library, and they can use that equipment to just learn on, to run into problems before customers ever do, or whatever it is. And so the idea was just, Blake, why don't you let us open up the lending library to you? And anything you want to use, we want you to come get, take it for as long as you want. And all we're asking in return is just push photography as far as you possibly can. Let's see what you can do. And that's where things started. That was the relationship with Blake, was just this guy that had a talent, and that we wanted to see if you match that talent with access to equipment, what happens, right? He was our experiment. And it's one that has been very fruitful, one that we've all, I think Blake included, have learned a lot from, and has definitely helped push the hobby very quickly in a direction and in a positive direction. And it's been exciting to watch, man.
In what way, Dustin, does that happen? Is it the techniques that can be developed when you have someone like Blake with the equipment that is state of the art, or in what way does the hobby get advanced? Is it new techniques, new processing, because not everybody has the state of the art stuff. So, is there just a knowledge base growth there?
So we have two goals here. The overarching goal for the company is to push this hobby as far as it possibly can. We feel like that's kind of the obligation we have, being the leader. We have to really set the bar on what can be done here, and we have to kind of find the limitations. And I feel like the new equipment are, they redefine the limitations. It's constantly a moving target, because as equipment gets better and better, which happens by the day, the bar gets raised by default. But that's only the case if you have talent that can, match that equipment's ability.
Yeah. So what becomes possible in the hobby is redefined when you match the talent with the equipment. I see.
Exactly. And so as we define what is the new bar, how good can things really be, how far can this be pushed, then our goal becomes, how do we simplify that? So now, how do we take this new bar and say, how do we make it a fraction of the cost to achieve? How do we simplify the processing techniques, and how do we make this something that a common user, not somebody that has access to Mount Wilson or Griffith, but somebody that just bought a system for their backyard and they're a hobbyist, how can they get images like this now? And then once they can, let's set the bar even higher, right? That's the goal. That's the process. And that's what we're constantly focused on.
Okay, I want to get into some astroimaging techniques a little bit later in the podcast, but while we're on the topic of, so this is how you got the story of how you got involved with OPT. Blake, tell us a little bit about how you're now getting involved in these observatories, these professional observatories.
The professional observatories is always something that I've had an interest in. I've longed for a long time to help conduct scientific research in any manner that I can. Science is something that I value greatly. I've always had a desire to understand the world around me and also share that with others. And what better way than science? Griffith Observatory was my first kind of venture into the professional realm of sharing science with the public, and also have an opportunity to work at my first, professional observatory. I don't know. It was a very interesting kind of thing how it happened. If I can give you a little bit of a backstory on exactly what was going on. I lived in Santa Barbara for a while after I had graduated. I was having fun there where I was working. But, I felt like I could do more. My buddy had moved in with me, and we said, we gotta do something in LA. That's what's really gonna, allow us to do what we want to do. And so over breakfast one morning, he said, well, what do you want to do in LA? And I said, well, I don't know. I guess I could work at Griffith Observatory. That sounds like that would be a pretty awesome thing to do. And he said, well, are they even hiring? And, I looked at my phone and I just typed in, jobs at Griffith Observatory. And sure enough, it said telescope operator hiring. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. They actually are. Yeah. I applied, and it, it, it took a while, but yeah, I've been there for 3 years, and I do a lot of juggling because I work at OPT during the week, and then I either go to Griffith Observatory or Mount Wilson to do work. And so we're actually doing a sort of long-term project for Griffith Observatory right now where we're updating the camera system. And so OPT is involved in that. We're going to make sure that they have the ideal camera system to share what we can capture with the public.
Talk about that scope a little bit. Blake was nice enough to give me a private tour of Griffith. Have you been there, Tony?
No, I haven't. That's one of the few, that observatory and the Mount Wilson ones I've never been to. So,
yes. Yeah, Griffith sits atop a mountain just outside of LA. You can see the entire city of LA from Griffith Observatory. It is stunning. I mean, it's like iconic, doesn't describe, like, it's believable being up there and just seeing this thing kind of perched above the entire city. But it's a moving experience, and that observatory is incredible. But talk about the scope that's in there a little bit, Blake.
Oh, yeah. So just going back for a split second here. Yeah, the observatory is very striking. It's a 1930s Art Deco, very, very gorgeous architecture. And the telescope actually has an interesting story as well. And so the observatory's main telescope there is the 1935 Carl Zeiss refractor. And the telescope was actually produced, I should go back. It was, believe it or not, ordered from a catalog.
was it really?
Yeah. And so the backstory was it's actually intertwined with Mount Wilson. So Griffith J. Griffith, who was a wealthy gentleman who made his money from silver, came to L.A. and he was invited up to Mount Wilson when they were doing, really active research at the time. And he was allowed to look through the telescope up there at Saturn. And he was just completely blown away because, Mount Wilson has some of the finest seen in the continental United States. It's usually about 0.5 arc seconds on average. And so, seeing Saturn through that telescope was just incredible. And he said, if the world could see what I saw through this telescope, it would just change everything. It would change our perspective on how we treat each other and just the universe in general. And they said, well, we certainly appreciate that, but this is a research facility and, you're kind of a VIP. And he said, well, you know what? I'm going to build my own observatory for the public, and people from all over the world can come here and see what I saw for free. And so thanks to him, we have Griffith Observatory. So that telescope, as I mentioned, was ordered from the Carl Zeiss optical catalog, I believe in 1931. It was completed in 1935. It actually has a sister telescope, the GuideScope, on top. There's a 9.5-inch refractor telescope. And they were separated for quite some time. And it's an interesting story about that as well. There was a gentleman named Shelley Studi who actually drove around the LA area with a 9.5-inch Carl Zeiss refractor mounted to the top of his car. And he would drive around, and he had this little telescoping pole. I think it was a Ford Model T of some sort, one of the later versions. I'm not too much of a car savvy gentleman, but he had this this contraption that would allow him to raise it up. And actually, if you visit Griffith Observatory, you look online, you'll actually see a picture of him with this like 10-foot long telescope, mounted to the top of his car, looking through it. He decided that he couldn't really keep doing that anymore. So he contacted Griffith Observatory and said, hey, are you guys interested in the scope? Of course, we said yes. It was actually made to be the guide scope for that 12-inch Zeiss refractor. What's interesting about the Zeiss factory, it was in Jena, Germany. And basically what happened was later on, of course, World War II started. And so Zeiss was, it was a manufacturer of optics for Germany. And so it was a strategic target during World War II. And so luckily the Zeiss Astro part of the factory was on the outskirts. And so it was actually spared from being obliterated. And then later on, the U.S. Army came in and actually confiscated the documents and blueprints for the telescope. And so not really much is known about the Zeiss telescope's inner workings, but it has a relatively complex system inside of it to keep the tube from flexing. To my knowledge, there's only four of those telescopes in the world of that specific kind. There's many other Zeiss telescopes. Some are larger, some are smaller. But that particular kind and its counterbalance system, we know of only four of them. And currently, the one at Griffith Observatory and one other one are the only ones in operation. So it's interesting.
So the objective diameter of the primary refractor is 12 inches.
That's correct.
Yes. And the guide scope is nine.
Nine and a half. Yeah.
Nine and a half. Wow. That's that is an impressive system. Well, the Zeiss optics have been world-class since they've been around. And even today they still are. I mean, a pair of Zeiss binoculars will set you back quite a bit as well. So, I mean, this must be an amazing optical system in terms of just the quality of the image that you're seeing. Can you just put an eyepiece on these telescopes and look through them?
Oh, absolutely. We have Teleview eyepieces, Explore Scientific eyepieces that we have on there. We have Meade eyepieces, Celestron ones. They all work wonderful on this telescope. We're really limited on just the atmospheric scene for this. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, this telescope's well over 80 years old. There's no optical coatings on it. They didn't really have them back then. You know, it's just the Zeiss glass lens. That's an 80-pound lens in the front. It's a doublet, and it's a achromatic or achromatic refractor. But, you know, it's a 15-foot-long scope. So that light focuses all on the, you know, the same focal plane. And when you get an image of Jupiter or Saturn.
Or the moon.
Or the moon.
Yeah, yeah, we looked at the moon and it was incredible.
Yeah, it's tack sharp. It's just gorgeous. So if you ever get a chance, definitely come check it out. We'd be happy to.
I'd love to. It's funny. I know a lot about many observatories around the world, from Chile all the way to Mauna Kea and just, you know, everywhere. But I don't know much about the ones in California. It's really weird. But it sounds like, and I don't know much about the ones in Arizona either. But the ones in this particular one sounds like it was designed from the beginning to be a sort of an outreach telescope, from the sounds of what you were saying about Griffith's initial response at Mount Wilson was, you know, everybody should look through this. And so he builds an observatory in a relatively, of course, at the time, it wasn't all that close by LA, was it? It was kind of dark when they first built Griffith's observatory, wasn't it?
That is true. And they actually have an interesting kind of documentary style movie that they show at the observatory that's actually narrated by the late Leonard Nimoy, that's very, very interesting about the history. And basically, Griffith knew that one day LA would be a world-class city. It would be a, you know, very, very large city. And so he planned ahead for this. And sure enough, we have him to thank for this wonderful, beautiful observatory up on the hill up there.
What I know about it, I've seen it in movies plenty of times, right? Because it's a very popular movie set, but it's only right from the outside looking in.
I believe that it's actually been featured in well over 50 movies.
I know. Yeah, it was. You said something about when you were telling me about what you did there before we started recording, that you also are part of the visitors. You are charge of the visitors that come up there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We have, between 400 to 700 people a night. And so basically my responsibilities up there when I work is I either operate the lawn scope or the Zeiss telescope itself. And basically we, as telescope operators as a whole, there are in charge of picking objects to observe that night. And sometimes it'll be, you know, depending on the year or the time of the year, I should say, you know, one or two objects and, you know, as many as five, depending on what's going on and, you know, what we're trying to do.
Say again, so, how many people show up a night?
About 400 to
every night.
Yeah. Every night.
Oh, whoa. Busy. Yeah. So you got to get 400 people cycling through the eyepiece.
Mm-hmm. And that's per telescope. So we have, mm-hmm. We have up to five telescopes operating at one point. So we estimate that we have at least 1 million visitors a year
Yeah, well, they run buses all night from the parking, which is a few, it's got to be a couple miles away. And then, yeah, there's these buses that come and pick up huge groups and take them up to the observatory.
Now, is this throughout the entire night time the sky is night, or do you like close at like midnight or something?
Up until the renovation, basically, as long as there was a line, they were open, which was great. But after the renovation, they've changed a few things. And so we operate from 7 p.m. To 10 p.m., or actually 9:30 on the telescope. The whole observatory, museum, and everything closes at 10, and it opens at noon. But the telescopes actually run from 7 to 9:30.
What are the objects that you show people that get the most intense reaction?
I would have to say probably Saturn. Saturn's everybody's favorite. You know, everybody, especially when we have a night of good seeing, and I can pull, you know, 400 times magnification. It just blows people away. I mean, they're really surprised that they can even see the gap in the rings. And, you know, I don't have the heart to tell them sometimes that you can actually kind of faintly make out the rings with a pair of binoculars. But the view is certainly spectacular through an 11-inch or a 12-inch telescope.
Sure. It's going to be a lot brighter. And yeah, the resolution is going to be a lot better as well.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. So, of course, Saturn. Yeah, Dustin and I have talked about that on many occasions. That we always like to be the one to show people Saturn through the eyepiece for the first time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Jupiter is another great one, especially when we have shadow transits, when the moons are transiting the face of the planet, and we have good seeing. And of course, when you know, everything aligns perfectly and the red spot is in view, it's pretty spectacular.
It really is just so tack sharp, though. I think that's the thing that stands out, because all we really had time for that night, because the lines were forming quickly, you know, and it was just us there in the observatory. And so we didn't want to hold everybody up too long. All we had time to do was really look at the moon. But even the moon through this scope is just, it wasn't like anything I had seen. You know, it's so incredibly sharp. It's really quite an experience being able to look through a scope like this. And the other scope you deal with is, I mean, much, much larger, right?
Oh, yeah. The 60-inch telescope is actually so large that when we look at Saturn, we actually have to climb on top of it and stand on it.
Yeah. So the other scopes you deal with is it's a 60 inch and then a 100 inch.
Yep. So we have a 1.5 meter and a 2.5 meter telescope up there on Mount Wilson. And, you know, those have quite a bit of history. I mean, the modern universe was discovered here in California, and also the expansion of it.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, so George Ellery Hale was the brains behind Mount Wilson Observatory, and it actually started as a solar observatory. George Ellery Hale had a fixation with the sun and trying to understand its inner workings. And so using the Mount Wilson Solar Observatory with what was called the SNOW telescope, which is a horizontal ceilostat, the 60-foot solar tower, and then later on the 150-foot solar tower, he was able to observe the spectrum of the sun, discover the magnetic fields using the iron line of the sun by checking it with polarization and seeing how it bowed out when you polarized the light. Even though his initial theory of how sunspots had magnetic fields was wrong, he still came to the same conclusion. And then later on, Edwin Hubble, we all know the Hubble Space Telescope, that was named after that gentleman. And so using the 100-inch telescope, which was the largest up until 1949, it was built in 1917. Back then, it was widely accepted in the scientific community that the Milky Way was just the entire known universe, and other galaxies were, you know, star systems that were forming out of a disk. And of course, there were many astronomers that said, no, you know, I don't think that's right. You know, I think these other galaxies are island universes like our own Milky Way. And so he had a hunch. He believed that if he could find what was called a variable star, a Cepheid variable, that he could measure the distance. And
why is that? Why does he need? I mean, if you're looking at something like the Andromeda Galaxy, which they would have known about for sure. I mean, this is discovered much, much earlier. I mean, there's what, roughly 200 billion stars there or more. I've heard estimates up to a trillion,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, close.
So if there's a trillion stars there, why does he need a variable star for this measurement?
The variable star is a very important star in astronomy. Normally, the distances to stars and objects in space are measured with parallax if they're close enough to us. And this was done with variable stars. And what we've discovered with variable stars is that they're like cosmic lighthouses. They're like kind of standard candles for measurement. And so the Cepheid variable star will brighten and dim with a specific period. And that specific period always corresponds to a specific brightness. And so by measuring the distance of one of these stars and knowing its brightness, if we were to find one, you know, further away, we could actually calculate roughly the distance that object is by knowing how bright the star should be and how bright it actually is. That allows us to kind of calculate that distance. And so on October 6th, 1923, Edwin Hubble was imaging what was then the Andromeda Nebula. And he found what he first thought was a nova. And there's a very famous image that basically was the final piece of evidence for this, basically. And it's called the VAR plate. And on the VAR plate, he had written initially in paint N for nova and then crossed it out and wrote VAR in red letters with exclamation point. And so he had found that night that variable star, which allowed him to calculate roughly the distance to the Andromeda Galaxy, which he came out to about 1.5 million light years. Of course, we know that the Andromeda Galaxy is around 2.5 million, but that was still enough to prove conclusively that the Andromeda Galaxy was an island universe like our own. And so the universe got a little bit bigger that night.
And so this happened at Mount Wilson Observatory.
That's correct. Right above Pasadena where JPL sits right now.
Wow. And this is also the place where it was found that the universe is expanding as well. Is that right?
That's correct. There was a gentleman also, and I always have trouble pronouncing this name, but his name was Vesto Slipher. And this gentleman used the telescope in Arizona to image over many, many nights all manners of galaxies. And he made these photographic plates. And Hubble kind of took his data and didn't really give him a lot of credit, but he used Mr. Slipher's data to actually prove, along with data from the 100-inch telescope, that the universe was expanding by measuring the redshifts of these galaxies. So, you know, just as a siren on an emergency vehicle will sound kind of louder as it's coming towards you and then kind of fade away as it's passing by, light does this as well. And so he found that the vast majority of these galaxies out there are moving away from us because their light was shifted towards the red. And then a few of them were shifted towards the blue, which told us that they were coming towards us.
Like Andromeda, which is going to just collide directly into us, right?
That's right. The Andromeda Galaxy is directly on a collision course with our own galaxy.
Yeah, that's a bummer. That's a bummer.
Interestingly enough, though, the distances between the stars are so vast that it's estimated that even though our solar system will have been long gone because our sun will have swelled into a red giant and right. ate our planet. The rest of our solar system would remain intact. It's not estimated that any stars would really collide into each other, or at least not very many of them.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing to me how many major discoveries have come out of this area. And, you know, especially considering, like you said, this was started for solar. Right. All of the research that was going to happen there. Actually, I have a piece of the bellows cloth from that observatory. Right. And that was the original purpose of the observatory was that solar research. And instead, they redefine at this place what the entire universe actually is and continue to do research in that direction. But I guess that's what got Einstein, because I know that you can't talk about Mount Wilson without talking about Einstein's participation there and his visits there. And that's what got him involved, right? Was that all of this research coming out of there was kind of it was giving him the tools he needed for all of the theories that he had been developing. So is that kind of the...
Yeah, I'm a little bit shaky on it, but I know he was there in 1931, and I'm told that one of the reasons he visited was not only just because it was a powerhouse of astronomy and astrophysics, which of course he was, you know, directly related to. I'm told that part of his theory of relativity didn't account for the expansion of the universe, which was discovered there. And so he was intrigued, you know, about this instrument that discovered it and the people there. And so he kind of visited secretly. He didn't really tell a lot of people that he was going to visit up there, because naturally, if Einstein's going to visit somewhere, everybody's going to show up and, you know, try and right. meet him. So there's a really famous picture on a great book, actually. It's called When We Discovered the Universe, or The Day We Discovered the Universe. And there's a bridge, and they call it the Einstein Bridge, that goes from the galley where the astronomers used to have their 2 a.m. lunch. There's a bridge that walks across to the 100-inch telescope. And you can see, and I'm trying to visualize everybody there. There's Einstein, there's Milton Humason, there's Edwin Hubble, and I believe Walter Botta. And they're all standing on this bridge. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that's one of the iconic images from up there. That and him visiting the 150-foot solar tower, and I'm told, you know, three people would go up at a time up the 150-foot solar tower bucket, basically. And if you ever visit Mount Wilson on a tour, this is a very, very small lift to get up there. It's literally a bucket that you stand in. And so I'm told that when Einstein was actually riding up there, there's a handbrake in case there's a failure and the thing, you know, starts to, you know, come down. And he was gripping it like, you know, like white knuckling it all the way up. But there's a really great photo of him up there standing by one of the Seelestat mirrors. And it's one of my favorites, actually.
So what are they doing now? You said earlier in the podcast that they're involved in some longer term research projects up there now. What are some of the things they're working on?
Well, there's the Chara Array, which is the Center for High Angular Resolution Astronomy. And it's actually the most powerful interferometer on the planet. I think it has a resolution of 0.0002 arc seconds.
So say some of that in English.
Basically, they can study extremely fine detail on other stars. They're able to actually measure the rotation of certain stars, image star spots, also image dust lanes around certain ones and actually deduce their shape. I believe Regulus is shaped like a lemon, basically. It's a prolate spheroid. It spins so fast. And that's one of the things that's come out of the Chara Array. And the Chara Array is 6 1-meter Mersenne-type telescopes. And basically, it collects the light from these 6 telescopes, and it literally sends it through pipes, light pipes, in a vacuum to what's called the beam collimation facility and the other facility that basically combines the light. And what they do is they measure not the actual images, but the fringes from these interference patterns that these telescopes create. And a lot of the physics is way over my head, but basically they study interference fringes to deduce information about these stars that they're studying.
You have anything to add to that, Tony?
Well, just only that is one of the most precise ways of measuring detail and structure in things that are very far away. By shooting all of these light signals through these light pipes or fiber optics or whatever they are, and then measuring the interference patterns of those signals, the way in which they arrive at the detectors and the interference patterns that are caused give you a lot of information. And that's one of the ways you can make telescopes the size of the Earth, because you can have these various telescopes all over the place, all over the planet, and all of them bringing their signals into one spot and looking at these interference patterns. You can literally see things like features, structure on the surface of a star. Stellar seismology is a good example of that. They measure the star quakes. You can see whether a star is active or not and things like that. So it's also the guiding principle behind the Event Horizon Telescope, which is a worldwide consortium of telescopes looking in to try and actually image the event horizon of the central black hole at the center of our galaxy, Sagittarius A star. So this is a very powerful technique, and it's being used all over the world for all kinds of different things. So it's cool to see that they're using that up in Mount Wilson. So we have these telescopes, Mount Wilson and then Griffiths over closer to LA. If I've learned anything from Dustin, what I've learned is that light pollution can be overcome in looking through these telescopes and imaging using these various telescopes. But what about the seeing? What's the seeing like at Griffiths compared, you know, is it really still as good as the day it was built?
So we do deal with a significant amount of light pollution, you know, from the LA area at both Griffith Observatory and Mount Wilson. At Mount Wilson, we're up just over a mile. And so the aerosols and, you know, various contaminants that would scatter light up higher are reduced. It's kind of interesting. I've been able to actually image M51, the Whirlpool Galaxy, with the 12-inch Zeiss telescope from Griffith Observatory. And a lot of people thought it was impossible.
Just because of light pollution and then not being an emission nebulae, you know, when you're imaging stars, you can't use a lot of the filters that, you know, basically the way the narrowband filters that allow you to cut through a lot of that light pollution, right? So
yeah, and it's pretty cool that I was able to do that. They said, you know, you're probably not going to be able to see too much, but we're going to give you some time to you know use a telescope to try and do this. And I was like, I'm pretty certain I'll be able to do it, because I live, when I'm in LA, around probably 6 miles from LAX. And so I've been able to image M51 there. I've been able to image the Orion Nebula. The Orion Nebula, of course, requires a significant light pollution filter. And I've done some narrowband as well. But M51, I've been able to do about 40 minutes. You just have to do considerably shorter exposures to pick up the detail. So I was doing about 45 second exposures. Normally you're doing, you know, 3 to 5 minutes of exposure, but it's definitely doable.
And that's just because of the sky background, or why do you have to cut the exposure time down?
Yeah, you start getting to what's called, at least in the film days, the sky fog limit. And that's when you're basically the contamination in the night sky from light pollution is starting to overpower your image of whatever you're taking a picture of. And so it's about getting a fine balance where you have just enough signal from the deep space target that you're trying to photograph versus that all that junk up there.
And what about the seeing itself, the seeing conditions? Like, do you have, I lived in Boulder, Colorado for many years, and there were nights because of the wind and the turbulence that I was lucky to get, you know, 5 arc seconds. Do you get pretty good seeing as far as the stability of the atmosphere there?
In LA, down where I'm at, usually the seeing's about 1 to 1.5 arc seconds. And it's gotten down as low as probably 0.6 just where I live. And that's relatively infrequent. That's usually, you know, a couple times a month I'll have seeing that good, which is still really good. Some people just never have that seeing at all. That's where I've been able to take some of my best photographs, is just from the backyard at, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning when Jupiter's up nice and high during different times of the year. As far as Mount Wilson goes, it's absolutely spectacular. It was surveyed. They actually had a survey telescope that they would bring up there and later on Palomar. And they would, you know, observe different stars at different altitudes and whatnot. And it was determined that because of the inversion layer that comes in laminar airflow, Mount Wilson sits in such a way that there's very little turbulence as that air kind of passes over. And so on average, our seeing is around probably 0.8 to 0.5 arc seconds. And I've seen it get as low as like 0.3, which is phenomenal.
Wow, that's really good.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, I'm always, you know, trying to describe this to people when we're at star parties and different events, but I don't think a lot of people really know what seeing means, that looking at the sky from different locations, whether you're in a desert or on top of a mountain or, you know, even on different sides of a mountain, what it means that the seeing would change. How would you describe that in the quickest, simplest way, Tony, to someone that had no idea what seeing conditions means, what 5 arc seconds means of seeing?
The way I describe it is, it's because we're underneath an atmosphere, and the atmosphere is if you've ever gone outside and you see a star twinkling, that's generally not great seeing, because it is the atmosphere, as the light passes through that atmosphere, basically just refracting the light in all kinds of different directions. So the better the seeing, the less twinkling that you have, the less atmospheric distortions that you would have. And it could be caused by just about anything, or all kinds of stuff, whether it's, you know, uneven heating of the Earth's surface, of the, you know, maybe a storm is coming through. Although you can get really good seeing in high wind if that high wind is laminar. In other words, if it's very steady, you can get some pretty good seeing. And so it is the effect of the atmosphere on making things sort of twinkle. If you're looking through a telescope, the worse the seeing is, let's say you're using a 30 power or 40 power eyepiece and you're looking at Betelgeuse, let's say the red giant, the star in Orion. And, you know, you'll notice that it really is jumping all around the eyepiece. It's just going crazy. And that's not good seeing. And so you want that to be as steady as possible. And generally, the colder the night, the colder the atmosphere, the better the seeing. Also, right after a storm front has moved in would also give you generally good seeing. So that's how I describe it to people. Blake, do you have another explanation maybe?
I tend to agree with you on all those notes, especially when it comes to planetary imaging. Yeah, just as the storm front's moving in, that's when I've had some of my best seeing. Even before the marine layer comes in, even that really tends to steady the air quite a bit. And I think one of the main misconceptions is, you know, just because it's clear outside doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to be a great view. Like you said, when those stars twinkle, that's you know, a lot of air mass distorting that light in front of it.
Yeah, and that's distortion. And so essentially, it's like you were saying, through a telescope, you're magnifying the problem. And so the worse the seeing conditions, the softer the image will look for a photographer. It looks like it's almost shifting out of focus even. And so it's not going to be a super sharp image. But I've always kind of described it as like when you look down a hot desert road and you can see those waves out in front of you, you know, that mirage of just heat coming off the road. It's like, I mean, you take that and then think about if you looked at that through a telescope, you would no longer be able to see the stuff behind it. All you would see is that distortion. All you would see would be those waves. And so trying to take a picture of something behind those waves is going to be extremely hard to do.
Yeah, we should do a podcast on magnification sometime, Dustin. Just talk about magnification and why, you know, just why you don't always want it. You don't always want it.
Exactly. A lot of times people shoot wide, you know, instead of using a long, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 millimeter focal length to really get high resolution on something. I'm seeing more and more people buy higher resolution sensors and put it on short focal lengths and then crop into the image so that you don't magnify the problems quite so much.
Yeah. If I may add one thing also, I actually ran into a bout of bad seeing actually the weekend before up at Mount Wilson. We had a music group up there that was filming. One of the things they wanted to do was capture some images with the DSLR through the 60-inch telescope. And unfortunately, it seemed like the jet stream was passing overhead because it was just, you know, even Alberio was just two blobs. You know, we tried the Perseus double cluster and, you know, we backed out all the way to a 100 millimeter lens, which is the biggest one that we have for the 60 inch. They were still blurry. You know, we decided to try a globular cluster because that's one of the things that they really wanted. And so I think we tried M15 and it was a gray smear. It was kind of funny, but it's interesting because a night of bad seeing is up there. You know, the demands that it has on the telescope is even more so. Like Dustin said, you know, you're greatly magnifying that effect when you're looking at it. But normally when you look at, say, M13 or, you know, M5 or something like that, it's absolutely spectacular when you look through that telescope. I mean, the 60 and the 100-inch telescopes are the largest in the world that you can actually look through. All the other ones are, you know, they have sensors on them and, you know, scientists use them. But I remember the first time I looked at M13 through the 100-inch telescope and we had like perfect seeing and you could count the individual stars in the center of it. It was just insane. It looked like a photo. It was like a transparency was just put up you know, somewhere inside the optical system.
Yeah, it's good seeing. Boy, you know it when you got it, right? I mean, it's like you could, stuff like that just pops out through the eyepiece. It's really quite extraordinary. Well, can I ask you now about planetary imaging? Because first of all, I'd like to know the difference in what the challenge is for imaging the planets versus, say, like you said, M13. What's different? And is there anything really all that different about planetary imaging? What do you have to worry about when you're imaging Mars that you don't have to worry about when you're imaging M51?
The main thing, there's a few, but the absolute main thing is the astronomical scene that we mentioned. If you can't, you know, see that fine detail on the planets, then, you know, it's a hopeless endeavor. And so the main thing is to have, you know, the best scene absolutely possible. And that'll allow you to image, you know, those sub arc second details on these planets. And then you want to have the right magnification, of course, because you don't want to basically oversample or undersample your data, which is something that can happen with, you know, deep space imaging, but it's not as critical. But let's say you oversample data, you want to err on the side of doing that. So you have basically too many pixels versus not enough. And what I mean by that is, let's say you're photographing a star cluster and you have very, very large pixels on your sensor. If you image those stars, you might not have stars that are large enough to excite enough pixels to actually give you a round image. So you end up with square stars, and that's undersampling your image. And then conversely, you have too many pixels and you're oversampling. And so you want to find an area right in between where it's perfect. And of course, if you have to err, like I said, on the side of one or the other, oversampling is okay. You're just losing a little bit of resolution. You're magnifying blur, basically.
Now, you adjust this by adjusting the focal length or magnification, yeah, or both?
Both, yeah. If you have, you know, another telescope that would suit, you know, that purpose better, by all means do that. But usually in planetary imaging, we're imaging with Barlows. And Barlows tend to have a bit of distortion as you move out towards the edges. But of course, in planetary imaging, we're occupying, you know, the very center of it, and then a small area on your chip, which is already really quite small, because you don't need, you know, a 35 millimeter camera to image Jupiter and Mars. They're only going to take up a few hundred or a few thousand pixels on that sensor.
Okay, so the pixel scale is important. That's what you're talking about. Also, the seeing is important. What other challenges are there in imaging planets?
Just finding the object can be very difficult.
Like finding Jupiter?
Oh yeah, believe it or not. I mean, you know, you look up and see Jupiter in the night sky and go, oh, there it is. But you know, when you're zoomed into like 10,000 millimeters or, you know, something like that, which is normally where you're at with a lot of these things, normally you want to be, you know, with a Newtonian, I think somewhere around F-15 or something like that. And then with a Cassegrain telescope, F20 or 30, we'll usually get you in the ballpark of the right magnification and sampling size. You know, the demands placed on your telescope's pointing accuracy and, you know, your setup, even your finder scope, you really have to have everything dialed in. And so it's recommended that, you know, you have a flip mirror or something like that. And the flip mirror has got to be, you know, a nice quality one too, because if there's any, you know, optical deviation when that mirror flips up, if it moves over to the left or right a little bit in the angle, then you're still not going to see the object. But it greatly helps, especially when you're photographing like the outermost planets like Uranus and Neptune, where even when you have them on your sensor, they just look like a TV static fuzzball.
So I know we're just about out of time here, but this was pretty amazing. And I'd like to know, because I haven't heard the conclusion of the story, but I know that you found a storm on one of these planets and were kind of like in the process of trying to, you know, image it again to see if that were the case. Like, tell me what happened there.
So yeah, it ended up being a very interesting thing. I can't go into too much detail about why we're there, other than we were recording video for an upcoming TV show, which hopefully pans out, because that would be really exciting. About that, I can't talk too much about. We had really, really excellent scene that night. And so the telescope operator and I was doing the imaging. we decided that, you know what, since the scene's really good, let's just image Uranus and Neptune. And so he was curious about different processing methods. And so once we had the telescope aligned on each object, I would get the computer running and the camera running and everything. And I'd show him, you know, how long I was recording the data for, what gain settings I was using. And then I was just processing the images as we went. And I just saw something really strange that I hadn't seen before on both Uranus and Neptune. Well, actually more so on Uranus, because Neptune has an internal heat source that causes storms to come and go somewhat infrequently that scientists are still trying to understand. But Uranus, I believe there's only been 3 times in history that there's been storms witnessed on it of significant size. And one was by Voyager 2 when it flew by. And then Keck, I believe, in 2014. And then there was a gentleman, Anthony Wesley, that discovered one, a gentleman in Australia. Really cool guy. Also, I would consider to be one of the top imagers of the planets in the world. The guy is amazing. We saw this kind of blip appear on the planet. And I said, hey, Richard, I think we might have something here. You know, it was getting late. It was around midnight. He was kind of ready to go home because he had another hour or so that he had to drive home after we were done. And so he said, well, you know what? We'll stay for another, you know, hour or so, just so we could try and get the rotation of the planet to see if this thing actually, you know, wasn't an image processing artifact. We took some more images, and I took the first one and processed it, and took the last one and processed it. And then I kind of flipped them back and forth, you know, like how people look for comets. It was actually how Pluto was discovered, flipping the images back and forth. And sure enough, this feature moved along the planet. And I said, oh, I think we discovered a storm. Like, this is a pretty big deal. So we posted it on Cloudy Nights and a few other places. I posted it on ALPO Japan, which is like the main planetary imaging website. But I was hoping, you know, more people could kind of look for this thing and confirm it. But what I hadn't realized is, you know, I'm imaging through a 1.5 meter diameter telescope. So I get a lot better resolution than most people do. So it's hard to confirm it, you know, without, you know, pointing the Hubble Space Telescope or the Keck or something, you know, at it. But I'm still convinced that we actually did discover that storm. I mean, you can clearly see it move. I've reprocessed that data, you know, 5 or 6 times in different methods to try and make that spot go away, but it's always there. So we tried to follow up with observations a week later, but unfortunately, the weather didn't really pan out. And the scene when it finally you know, wasn't cloudy was pretty terrible. So we're hoping that it's still there and we'll have another, you know, shot at trying to image it. And hopefully in the meantime, some other astronomers around the world will be able to detect it several more times and really prove that this thing is out there.
How long ago was this?
Let's see. It's about 3 weeks ago now.
So do we have any idea how long these storms last?
The storms on Uranus, I think, are relatively poorly understood. Like I said, some of our data was really only from the Voyager 2 spacecraft as it passed by, and then occasional observations by the Keck. But I'd imagine, you know, from data that we have on Jupiter, these storms could last a matter of weeks to, you know, sometimes months or years. So it's really hard to tell. But one of the things I did using the WinJupos program, which is a program for derotating or unsmearing, you know, long video files of planetary images, it also has the ability to measure features. And I measured the feature at about, I believe, about 6,000 miles across, or 6,000 kilometers. And initially, I thought that might have been too big, but I believe Jupiter's red spot right now is about 9,600 kilometers across. So that would fit, I think, pretty well with the size of Uranus. Yeah, only time will tell, really. Hopefully somebody with a bigger telescope will be able to be pointing at it at the right time.
My favorite part of that story is when you said, you know, but then I forgot I'm using a meter class telescope.
Yeah.
Well, that's really great. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but I think we're out of time because I had some questions on things like exposure times and things like that for planets. So we're going to have you back, Blake, to talk more about this.
Oh, no problem. I'd love to.
Great. Thank you. All right. Well, I guess we'll call it. Well, we'll stop there, folks. My guest today was Blake Estes. He works at OPT as a tester and a lot of other roles there at the company, but he also is a telescope operator for the telescopes at the Griffith Observatory and Mount Wilson. And he is one of the best planetary imagers that's out there. So I want to thank you for taking time out to talk with us about your work, because that's really cool. And we will hopefully have you back to talk about more nuts and bolts and nitty gritty details of how to take images through planetary images through a telescope. So we look forward to that.
Sounds great. Looking forward to it.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for listening. This is another episode of Space Junk. We will be back next week. And I want to thank you all so much for listening. And as always, keep looking up. Space Junk was produced by OPT Telescopes in Carlsbad, California, in partnership with Deep Astronomy. Please send feedback and questions to spacejunk@deepastronomy.com.